Kick back, relax. It's time for the Unconventional Ufologist.
Hi, I'm Steve Yarwood and welcome to the Unconventional Ufologies podcast. In this episode, I'm not only digging up a brilliant archival case, but one of my favourite archival cases. This episode is called The Little Men Who Are Definitely Not Asking for Directions, or On the Surprising Difficulty of Kidnapping an Extraterrestrial in Venezuela and Other Lessons in Cosmic Impertinence. 1. A modest proposition involving hair, rocks and unlicensed space travel. It's a profoundly underrated feature of the human condition that when faced with something utterly inexplicable, say a glowing orb hovering 6 feet above a quiet country road in the dead of night, gently bobbing like a buoy in the cosmic bathtub, most people will default to one of two impulses. Either A, run like hell, or B, try to take it home. Gustavo Gonzalez, a 25-year-old Cuban businessman then residing in Venezuela, belonged firmly, if fatefully, to the second camp. Now, to be fair, Gustavo was not entirely without excuse. He was, by all accounts, a serious, hard-working man. Every morning at 2 a.m, he and his assistant, Jose Ponce, drove their van along Buena Vista Road in Petare, a suburb just outside Caracas, to collect meat from the Industria Nacional de Embutidos, C.A. I apologise for the pronunciations. This company was charmingly nicknamed Shelper, which I should have gone with in the first place, which aside from sounding like a sneeze, also produced sausages of the sort one might expect to find at a modestly successful picnic in 1954. This was not the life of a man prone to flights of fancy, yet on the morning of November the 29th, 1954, at approximately 2:15 a.m, Gustavo exited his vehicle, walked towards a luminous sphere the size of a large beach ball, and attempted to kidnap an alien. Nope, this isn't a metaphor, he really did it, with his bare hands. He didn't do this because he was drunk, he wasn't, because he was sleep deprived, though he might have been, or because he'd recently watched too many science fiction films, though Venezuela in 1954 likely had a robust selection of Hollywood imports featuring rubber-suited monsters. No, Gustavo acted, one presumes, out of a combination of entrepreneurial spirit, machismo, and that peculiar human conviction that if something small and hairy is standing in the middle of your delivery route, it is probably your problem to solve. And so he lunged, wrapped his arms around the nearest extraterrestrial and hoisted it off the ground. At which point the universe, in its infinite and slightly exasperated wisdom, responded with what can only be described as a cosmic facepalm. 2. An inventory of things that did not go according to plan. Now, let's mention a few things for clarity's sake. The assumptions Gustavo had likely made in that fateful moment and how each was swiftly and violently disproven. Assumption number 1. The creature is light, like a child or a small dog. Reality, the being weighed approximately 50 kilograms or 110 pounds, dense, muscular and surprisingly heavy for its 3-foot stature. Gustavo later described it as solid as a sack of wet cement. And this is not the weight of a creature that spends its days sipping herbal tea and collecting wildflowers. This is the weight of something that bench presses boulders for fun. Assumption number 2. It'll be docile, perhaps frightened. Reality, the alien, hairy, noseless, barefoot, cloaked in what generously might be called a loincloth, reacted with the kind of fury usually reserved for telemarketers who call during dinner. It broke free with preternatural agility, spun around and delivered a blow so forceful that Gustavo was flung 15 feet through the air and onto the pavement. This was not a slap. This was not even a punch. This was the kind of kinetic reprimand that suggests the alien had once taken martial arts lessons from a disgruntled anvil. Assumption 3. If worst comes to worst, a knife will do the job. Reality. Gustavo, ever the pragmatist, produced his Boy Scout knife and stabbed the creature in the shoulder. The blade skittered off its hide like rhinoceros skin, leaving no mark, no blood, no impression whatsoever, except perhaps the faint sense that the alien was mildly insulted by the attempt. Assumption number 4, that there was only one of them. Reality, two more emerged from the shadows, one clutching dirt, the other brandishing what looked like a flashlight. And then, perhaps sensing the human's growing panic, a fourth appeared near Jose Ponce, arms full of rocks, eyes gleaming with what can only be interpreted as territorial resolve. Assumption number 5, they're here to talk. Reality, one of them blinded Gustavo with a searing beam of light, another zapped Jose with a paralysing vibration. They didn't speak, they didn't gesture, they simply collected soil samples, fought back with terrifying efficiency, and retreated into their glowing orb like interstellar commuters who had just realised they'd missed the stop. In short, Gustavo's plan, which may have involved selling the creature to a carnival, presenting it to the Venezuelan government, or simply keeping it as a very unusual pet, crumbled faster than a stale cracker under the weight of cosmic indifference. 3. The supporting cast. Witnesses, bureaucrats, and a very confused doctor. What makes the November the 29th incident particularly compelling, aside from the sheer audacity of trying to show an alien into a meat van, is the sheer volume of corroborating testimony. This was not a lone drunk stumbling home and mistaking a raccoon for a Martian. This was a coordinated, multi-witness event that rippled through the Caracas Valley like a poorly timed fireworks display. Within minutes of the encounter, Gustavo and Jose arrived at the Patara traffic office, breathless, bruised, and babbling about hairy dwarves and flying orbs. The officers on duty, Manuel Moreno and E. Dominguez, later confirmed that the men were neither intoxicated nor delusional. They were, in fact, packed with details that seemed real enough. Gustavo's left side was bruised and swollen. An x-ray later that afternoon revealed muscular distension, not broken ribs, but enough trauma to suggest he had, indeed, been launched through the air by something with a serious grievance. Meanwhile, a lab technician named Dr. Julio Garces reported hearing a scream of terror issued by a squealing voice while nearing near Buena Vista around the same time. He saw nothing, but the sound alone was enough to make him stop his car in fear. Further afield, residents described a bluish intense light rising skyward, accompanied by a sharp whistling sound and something resembling an explosion, though no crater, no fire, no debris was ever found. Mrs. Elsa Duderstadt, gardening in Los Palos Grandes, watched the orb descend, change colour and vanish. Her son, Rodolfo, swore it was real, so did her niece Ursula. Entire neighbourhoods were awake, standing in their yards, debating whether this was a secret government weapon, a meteor, or, God forbid, something else. Even more remarkably, the manager of Shelpa, Antonio Kerchi, vouched for Gustavo and Jose's character. They were reliable, punctual, never late with their pre-dawn pickups. If they said they'd fought off space dwarves, well, maybe they had. This is the point at which most UFO stories dissolve into anecdote, hearsay and grainy photographs. But here in Venezuela in late 1954 we have names, times, medical reports, police statements and civilian witnesses, all converging on a single, absurd, inexplicable night. 4. The sequel nobody ordered, but the universe delivered anyway. If this had been an isolated incident, a one-off cosmic hiccup, we might chalk it off to mass hysteria, sleep deprivation, or unusually aggressive troop of howler monkeys. But the universe, never fond of encores, wasn't done. Hunters Jesus Gomez and Lorenzo Flores, deep in the woods, stumbled upon the same 3-foot glowing orb. 4 hairy dwarves emerged and attempted to abduct Gomez. Flores, weapon in hand, but gun not loaded, because of course it wasn't, clubbed the creatures with his shotgun. The weapons shattered on impact, the aliens unharmed, fought back briefly, then retreated into their orb and vanished. Both men returned home, torn, scratched and deeply unsettled. December the 18th, 1954, near San Carlos del Zulia, Jesus Paz stepped into the woods to answer nature's call, a universally vulnerable moment, the cosmic equivalent of stepping into a phone booth during an earthquake. His friends heard a scream. They found him unconscious, clothes shredded, body marked with scratches. As they rushed to help, a small hairy figure bolted from the bushes, leaping into a waiting orb and shot in the sky. December the 19th, 1954. In Valencia, jockey Jose Parra saw six of the creatures loading rocks onto a disc-shaped UFO. Before he could flee, one zapped him with a purple ray that paralysed him instantly. When he recovered, the aliens were gone, but police later found anomalous footprints at the scene. And then, retroactively unearthed, way back 7 months, April the 10th, 1954, Emilio Martinez, hunting near Caracas, was chased by two monkey-like humanoids. One tackled him, bit and scratched him, until Martinez struck it with a rock. The only thing that seemed to hurt them, rocks. It bled, screeched and fled. Both creatures then beat on his car windshield before he sped away. This was not a pattern, this was a spree. 5. The Great Monkey Debate, or How to Explain the Inexplicable with Local Wildlife. Naturally, sceptics have had a field day here. Venezuela has howler monkeys, large, loud, aggressive primates that stand about 3 feet tall, sport black or reddish-brown fur, and are known to attack if provoked. Could Gustavo have mistaken a foraging monkey for an alien? Could the glowing orb simply have been headlights reflecting off fog? Possibly, but howler monkeys do not 1. Operate silent self-propelled orbs of light, 2. Carry rocks with apparent purpose, 3. Wear loincloths, 4. Possess rhinoceros hide skin impervious to knives, 5. Emit paralysing rays or blinding beams, and 6. Vanish into spherical vehicles that ascend vertically at impossible speeds. Furthermore, the sheer consistency of the descriptions across multiple independent witnesses, hairy, noseless, 3 to 4 fingers, glowing eyes, barefoot, loincloth clad, suggests something more than misidentified fauna. And the clustering of incidents within a 40-day span, or within the Caracas region, speaks to either a very localised outbreak of mass delusion, or a very localised extraterrestrial field trip. 6. The folklore angle, where myth meets matted hair. But let's not forget South America's rich tradition of small, hairy, forest-dwelling humanoids. Long before UFOs, the region whispered of Tata Duende, thumbless, mischievous, goblin-like beings from Mayan and Caribbean folklore, known to lure children into the woods. Aluks, tiny elfin guardians of the Yucatan, said to protect sacred spaces, and occasionally throw rocks at intruders. Baklu, a child-sized hairy dwarf from Brazilian legend. Shiru, a 4 to 5 foot tall hairy humanoid from Colombia. And finally, Didi Anguayatsi, rock-throwing imps from Guyana. Notice anything? Small stature, hairy, aggressive, fond of rocks, no thumbs, well, at least reduced digits. Could these encounters be modern manifestations of ancient cryptid lore projected into the new mythical framework of flying saucers? Perhaps. The human mind seeks patterns, and when faced with the incomprehensible, it reaches for the nearest story that fits, even if that story involves interdimensional leprechauns. 7. The cosmic irony of rock-based defence. Perhaps the most delicious detail in this entire saga is the apparent vulnerability of these hyper-advanced beings to rocks. Emilio Martinez struck one with a stone and it bled. Lorenzo Flores shattered his shotgun on their bodies, but rocks, blunt and primitive, seem to be the one thing that hurts them. Meanwhile, they also seem to be collecting rocks, loading them onto their craft with evident purpose. It's possible they're not invaders, but scavengers, archaeologists, geologists, or more alarmingly, are they removing Earth's only natural defence against them? If that's the case, they're going to need a bigger ship. Picture it, an alien species, technologically superior in every way, yet evolutionary, vulnerable to silica-based, blunt trauma. Their solution? Quietly remove all loose stones from key landing zones. A geological disarmament. It's absurd, it's brilliant, and exactly the kind of logistical oversight you'd expect from a civilization that can fold space-time, but forgets to bring gloves. 7. Why Gustavo's mistake was also humanity's. Gustavo's fatal error wasn't just grabbing an alien, it was assuming the universe operates on human terms. We like to believe that intelligence implies communication, that technology implies benevolence, or at least curiosity, that small things are harmless. But nature, and by extension the cosmos, is under no obligation to be polite. A scorpion's small, a box jellyfish is elegant, but neither cares whether you meant well. The hairy dwarves of Venezuela exhibit no interest in dialogue. They don't wave, they don't scan for water. They don't ask us for directions. They arrive, they collect soil and rocks, they defend themselves with brutal efficiency, and then they leave. They're not here to teach us. I don't think they're here to conquer us. They're here to, well, do a job. And if you get in the way, they'll punt you across the road. This is perhaps the most unsettling implication of the 1954 encounters, that we are not the main characters in the universe's story. We're just background noise, wildlife to be avoided, a nuisance near the rock pile. 9. The aftermath, silence, stigma, and national security. Following the incidents, Venezuelan authorities, specifically national security, reportedly swept the area, questioning residents, searching lots, and discouraging public discussion. Many witnesses stayed silent, fearing ridicule or worse. The press barely covered it, and scientists ignored it. And so the story faded, passed down in UFO circles, revisited by bloggers, dissected by podcasters, but never integrated into the mainstream. Why? Because it doesn't fit. It's too messy, too physical, too violent. Most alien encounters involve lights in the sky, missing time, implants, telepathy. Clean, clinical, almost sterile. But this mud, blood, torn shirts, shattered shotguns, a man getting slapped into next week by a 3-foot-tall space goblin. It's embarrassing, it's undignified, and therefore, it's probably true. 10. A final thought. The universe is not your friend, but it is occasionally entertaining. In the end, the Hairy Dwarf Aliens of Venezuela teaches a simple, almost childlike lesson. Don't grab things you don't understand. The universe is full of glowing orbs, whispering forests, and small hairy beings with unclear motives. Some of them collect rocks. Some of them paralyse joggers. Some of them vanish into lights that change colour like mood rings. And while it's tempting, deeply, humanly tempting to reach out, to touch, to capture, to own, perhaps the wiser course is to sit in your van, roll up the windows, and drive very, very quietly away. Because the cosmos has a sense of humour, and it finds it hilarious when humans try to put aliens into the back of a meat truck. Epilogue, a modest defence of howler monkeys. In fairness to Venezuela's native primates, no howler monkey has ever been credibly accused of operating a spherical UFO, emitting paralysing rays, or even wearing a loincloth. They are, however, excellent at making noise, climbing trees, and looking profoundly unimpressed by humanity. If they were behind this, they'd deserve an Oscar. But until a howler monkey is caught loading rocks into a glowing orb while wearing a tiny fig leaf, we must concede something else was in those woods. Something small, something hairy, and something that really, really, really didn't appreciate being hugged. Thanks for listening. I'm the Unconventional Ufologist. See you next time. You take care, and remember, keep watching the skies.